The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, Philly. Before we begin, we ask that you please silence your cell phones and that you refrain from any photography or recording. And now, the Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to welcome Carrie Brownstein and Adie Bryant.
Hi guys, thanks for coming.
Yeah, hi guys. Carrie's gonna read.
I'm gonna read for 2.5 minutes, and then we're gonna talk about politics. We're actually not. I don't know what I have. I can't believe you guys whooped for that.
I have a hard-hitting list of questions that I'm going to frickin' rock her with.
Okay. We're gonna,
okay.
If you picked up that book, we could read in unison. Oh, let's not do that. Okay. This, I guess to set this up, this is takes place during the tours for... this is about 1996. We're on tour for an album called Call the Doctor, and when I say we, it's a band called Sleater-Kinney. I haven't done this like handheld plus. Okay.
If you want me to turn the pages, I will.
Okay. Tour is a strange beast. What constitutes comfort and cleanliness is relative. In 1996, I was 22. I slept on couches that had been purchased at Goodwill or hauled in from the sidewalk. I made a bed on any number of surfaces with unknown unsavory provenances. I showered in plastic stalls mottled with mold and borrowed shampoo, toothpaste, and even towels. I never wore slippers. At night, we'd haul in the foam mattress from the van, which we had nicknamed PM for pube magnet. Since all it did was collect small stray hairs that would be carted back to the van and stick with us for the remainder of tour. From the stage, we'd politely ask for a place to stay, a humbling process that negates any sense of coolness or respectability. On the US tours, I would read novels about the states through which we were passing, trying to populate the vastness, the long stretches of green and brown and grays, with characters I could grow to know and love. Willa Cather kept me company in Nebraska and the upper Midwest. I read Joseph Mitchell essays about the Bowery and tales from James Baldwin's Harlem before arriving in New York. Capote's Other Voices, Other Rooms accompanied me through the South. For the West Coast, I brought along Joan Didion essays and the writing of Wallace Stegner. Books grounded me, helped me to feel less alone. Technically, I was around people all the time on tour, but I often felt estranged from my bandmates, unknown. Perhaps this was depression, a murkiness that distorted and disabled connection. I drifted in and out of this darkness, pulled away, then reappeared. In Atlanta, after playing a show during which a gaggle of topless women took over the stage during our set, we ended up at a house owned by a gregarious rockabilly dyke named Rizzo. She must have stayed at her girlfriend's that night because we let ourselves into her house. Inside were two pit bulls, one of which was in heat, bloody towels on the kitchen floor. I slept under a leather S&M-clad mannequin hung from the ceiling in the bedroom. Another option was to crash at the promoter's house or with the opening band. I rested my weary head on unwashed pillows in beds we were lucky enough to get because someone's roommate was out of town. We slept in dorm room bunk beds after college shows or on industrial sofas in the common areas of university housing. But mostly we slept on floors, rolling out sleeping bags a few inches from one another, no privacy, no distinction between one grimy human shape and another, stinky breath and feet and snores and twitches all merging into a feral pile. It was an endless, slovenly slumber party. Tour is the aspect of being in a band that many people assume is the most glamorous. Perhaps you imagine a private jet filled with champagne and puppies, backstage areas with white leather couches and ornate lamps, an on-call barista, a masseuse. And yes, all this is possible, but it will cost you. Though I know of bands that travel with exercise machines, personal chefs, fitness trainers, and Persian rugs, most musicians, even ones headlining major festivals and selling out large-scale shows, have a goal of making tour profitable. They'd rather spend money on production and design, on bringing extra musicians, on lighting and sound rigs, rather than, say, a chocolate waterfall in their dressing room. During the early years of touring, I came to the realization that we were just as much movers as we were musicians. After all, without the benefit of a crew, essentially what we did each night was pack and unpack, load and unload, and lift heavy objects from vans into rooms and then back into vans. The plainness of those actions, the bluntness, is so much of what I remember about Call the Doctor. The album took what is rote and routine and made the motions desperate, alluring, a trap. We blamed the simplification of our identities and the outside world's doubt in our abilities, not only on sexism, but on a paucity of imagination. We were monsters. We weren't like you. We might have been movers, but we were coming to steal what you thought was yours.
Now I'm going to read from my diary.
Oh my God, I wish you would.
I know. No, I'm not. That was such a perfect example of how excellent this book is. I had the joy of reading it, and throughout the whole thing, I kept being like, oh my God, she's so cool. But then at the same time, I was like, oh, these are really similar to my experiences coming through like a comedy trajectory, particularly the touring stuff, because in many ways, there's nothing worse to me than being on tour. And I mean, for me, touring pre-SNL versus post-SNL was a very different experience because nobody gave a shit what I was doing before. So I have a series of quick, easy questions that I thought we could start with just to lube you up here.
Like one-word answer questions?
Yeah, like brief, easy.
Like a lightning round.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be one word, but, you know, we're going to kick through a couple and then we'll dig down into the nasty shit. How does that sound? Okay, since we're just talking tour, I was thinking, what was your worst venue or, like, worst moment on tour where you were just, like, performing and being like, no one here wants to hear any of this, and it is bad.
There's a couple of those. One is playing in Seattle early on to four people.
Mm-hmm. I've been there.
And my dad was one of them. And, I mean, what is the point of playing? There is only one more person in the audience than is in the band. We could have just swapped. That was embarrassing. And then there was a venue in France. One of my pet peeves early on was just no bathroom backstage. Mm. So, but you know, it's fine. So you wait in line to go to the bathroom before you play with people that are waiting for you to play and are annoyed you're not on stage. And I'm like, if you let me pee, we would play. But then they don't. It's a weird passive-aggressive dynamic. But it's also fine. Who cares? But in France, it was in Marseille, and the toilet was a co-ed toilet. It was just a hole in the ground. And you just squat. You just squat and go.
No.
Yeah. Yes. And then you get on stage, and you're like, look at me now. It was so disgusting.
Yeah, it's horrible.
So there's a lot of that. There was definitely years and years of not years and years, but a couple years of not playing to that many people.
I've done, one time I did a comedy show where the only bathroom was backstage. So during the comedy show, occasionally people would just be like. So that they could go and pee or poop. And those were humbling moments for me.
Now, I've definitely played where in cafeterias, where over the music, they're like, Bob, your pizza's ready.
I have too. Once I played in a college cafeteria where they were like, students were watching a basketball game on a TV while we were doing musical improv. And they did not like that. Okay, another lightning round question. What's your favorite dessert?
I like a chocolate sundae. I like, like ice cream with...
Great.
With chocolate syrup.
Yes.
Whipped cream and nuts and maybe sugar. Like a classic, like sundae. What's your favorite dessert?
All. But I also really like just like straight up ice cream or straight up cake.
I love grocery store birthday cake.
That's me too.
So good.
Sheet cake. Nothing.
Yeah, and I'm not talking Whole Foods. I'm talking about like a Safeway cake with an amazing.
Yeah, Jewel is what we had in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I always was like, oh, I love a Jewel cake.
Yeah, like. The thick layer of frosting.
Yeah.
So good. I also like an ice cream cake.
Woo! Now that deserves applause. Okay, I'll give you another lightning round here. Okay. If you were to close your eyes and imagine like your ultimate, like favorite powerful outfit to perform in, what would that be? Do you have like what you imagine yourself as like a guitar god? What are you wearing?
When Slater Kinney played Letterman this year, I wore a silk white jumpsuit.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much my most favorite thing I've ever worn.
Hell yes. Okay, that's a good one. Did I just compliment myself or her? Let's find out. Okay. And then just like maybe a couple of your favorite cities to play.
Well, Philadelphia.
Woo!
Number one city to play.
I set you up for that. You owe me $50.
I really do love playing Philly. I love playing Chicago. It's always one of our best.
Oh my God, yes.
And gosh, and Atlanta.
Ooh, shocker. Okay, that's cool. Well, now let's get into the nasty one, shall we? I just realized that my boob was out a little bit. Okay, thank you. Okay. This is such a heavy question for what the vibe is right now, but I feel that I still have to go there. Okay. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my own personal journey with Slater Kinney. I went to college in 2005, and so it was like perfect timing where I moved to Chicago to go to school, and I met all these girls who were like cooler and smarter than me, and they just like changed my world and became my best friends still to this day, and they like introduced me to the Woods, and it became like our album that we would listen to like driving to the Chicago suburbs thrift stores and like hanging out together, and to me, it was just like, it's just the most powerful I ever felt for the first time. Like, the first time I felt that, like, a powerful young lady doing her own damn thing was to your music. So then sometimes when I was reading about what a tough time it was for you, it really, like, reframed those songs for me in a way that I was like, oh, Carrie, I'm so sorry. You know, that... I guess my question is it ever hard to play songs that came from like a hard moment in your own life that is your own story when maybe your fans have a positive memory attached to that? Do you know what I mean? Like, these are your stories, really, and Corin's and Janet's, and that, like, other people have this attachment that might be really positive or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's really, I mean, I think there's just a tacit agreement that there is no way to always meet, like, that there's not always a matched experience,
yeah.
You know, a parity of experience, that there's just so much multiplicity in how people perceive something. And I, songs that we wrote from a place of that sadness, like Jumpers is a really sad song, written about suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge and written during a time when I was feeling my own sense of despair. I think people definitely now, when we were playing, I could see that people had come to that song sometimes during their difficult times in their own life, but I would be feeling really happy.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm playing this song and it's, to me, it's one of our favorite songs. And it's not one of our favorite songs because it's sad. It's one of our favorite songs because it's such a great live song. But we would look out and I would see people crying.
Yeah, of course.
During that song. And then it would strike me. And then I would, and I feel like the way that songs are mutable, that way that in one moment you can feel ecstasy and two lines later, you're devastated. Like I go through that too, and it's not necessarily because of my own relationship to the song anymore, but that's what's so beautiful about playing live is, you know, that you feel porous, you're open to that, the feeling in the room. So it changes all the time for me.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, and again, this is like my own comedy perspective, but there have definitely been nights where I go out there and I'm like feeling it. And then there are other nights when it feels like a job and I just go out there and I like do my business. And sometimes I wonder for these things that are attached to like such personal stories, can you do that?
We really try to take songs out of the set list that any of us feel ambivalence about.
That's what I wonder.
And I don't mean like emotional ambivalence, like I can't get into this, the mm-hmm. space of the song anymore, but just for whatever arbitrary reason, one of us is tired of playing it or it feels rote or routine at this point. You know, we definitely, you know, we operate like a collective and we'll put a song down that even might be a song that we know the audience would want to hear, but we'd rather just not play it if it's like, oh, I'm tired of that one.
Yeah.
So we really try to play the songs that we can still live inside of every night and give life to.
Ooh, she's good, huh?
You're good.
Ooh, I'm trying. Okay, here's another one for you. Yeah, another hot one off the presses. I was also struck by some of, like, how difficult some of your experiences were with the media. I mean, some, like, traumatic outing, and then also, like, just how kind of shitty, like, questions about, like, women in rock bands can be, and kind of, I don't know, dismissive and rude, and I wonder, though, how now to promote this book, and also to, you know, promote No Cities to Love, how, like, what is the experience that you want people to see your art, and part of that is promoting it, but that you also have to kind of put it through this filter that you have no control over? How has that been for you, sort of on the other side of it?
Yeah, the way that things are framed are always difficult, and we're definitely in an era of clickbait, and to me, the most asinine versions of an interview come out where it's so condensed and decontextualized that anything that felt like the semblance of a interesting conversation is just lost. And then you feel frustrated. And sometimes I think, why am I, you know, I should have known, I should know better. But then occasionally something will come out that feels really apt and insightful. I really like, there was a great interview with Jen Pelly, who I think is a really good writer for Pitchfork. And I liked, there was a piece in The Guardian, like every once in a while you have an enlightening conversation with someone, not because of what you're saying, but because of what they're bringing to it. And I really still, I value journalism still. And and sometimes it feels naive to go into things and you hope, well, this is going to be illuminating for someone or someone will have something interesting to say, and they don't always. But when it works, or cultural criticism works, I'm always pleased. But there's always a, I don't know. Yeah, it's like I want people to read the book.
Right. Yeah, you guys, freaking read the book. I'm curious, too, do you ever now also get, like, women in comedy questions?
Do you get women in comedy questions?
I mean, yes, but I assume you do, too, right? It's a moment for women in comedy right now, if you haven't heard.
I feel so fortunate because I've been able to live through the moment for women in music and the moment for women in comedy.
Oh, poor women, they can only have one moment.
I get asked about that somewhat. You know, I think because what's interesting is because I am in a duo with a guy, I don't get asked that as much because they think of us as such a duo. So I feel like I read people getting asked that question all the time.
Yeah.
All of you guys on SNL, Schumer,
yes,
Poehler,
yeah,
all the time, and it's such an analog to the questions about, you know, how does it feel?
Yeah,
my stock answer for many years, and I just answered it again this morning, is that talking about it is part of the experience. How does it feel? Well, it feels like answering this question. You can't separate it from the experience anymore.
I mean, reading that portion of your book where you had all those sections from different publications about writing about, I felt so like, that's me! Because it is so, like, truly maddening. I don't know.
It's just very, it's reductive and it's unsophisticated.
Yes.
It's very frustrating.
Life sucks. What the hell are we gonna do? Thank you to that one woman's sturdy laugh.
Let's get her a mic, too. And it just feels like a three-way conversation between us and a solid laugher.
Okay.
Are we going to... Is it going lighter or...?
No, it's going darker.
Okay.
So much darker. No, wait, I'm going to skip that one. Okay, here's one. Since... We'll go a little lighter. Since we were just talking about Fred. Yes! I love Fred, too. He was on SNL my first year, and he was like my little guide. He was an angel to me. And I feel that, especially like reading about how powerful like your connection was and how powerful like the work was that came out of your collaboration with Corin, and then also to see the kind of things that come out of your work with Fred, I wonder what you feel about the power of like collaborating with another person as opposed to, because especially for myself, sometimes I came up doing like sketch and that type of thing. It's really reliant on ensemble. So when I see stand-ups out there like hacking it on their own, I'm always like, damn, what is it in you that makes you want to go out there and do it alone, because I feel the opposite. And I feel like you have such a strong connection with Fred and with Corin and Janet that, I don't know, it reads in your work. And I wondered if Fred and Corin share any traits that you think make them work together well with you. And, you know, what do you think of them? Do you think they're cool?
They are cool. Both of them are pretty cool. You know, they're two of the kindest people I know, for sure, and they're fiercely loyal. Corin is my most loyal friend. She's such a fierce supporter of people who she loves. Fred just goes through the world with a curiosity. He's such a yes guy, and I was such a no person for so long. You know,
yes, I'm still a no person,
and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I liked that. That perspective,
yeah.
And Corin is shyer than Fred is, but I think they share a certain kindness that I feel really drawn to. They're both, I trust them a lot, and I think, they just share an openness. I think and I've learned from both of them in that way.
And I was curious too. Like, I loved that the book really focused on like the story of your music and your band. Did you ever, for any moment, feel like you needed to include Portlandia in it more? Or what made you decide to kind of just let this story be?
I think the themes of the book and the journey of the book, which is in some ways from feeling disembodied to embodied, from feeling outside and kind of uncomfortable and through creativity and community finding a sense of belonging and recognition, Slater-Kinney as an entity served that narrative better. So it was definitely a creative choice. And also in terms of a structure that I really loved was Steve Martin's Born Standing Up. And he tells of his childhood and his working at Disneyland and clowning and stand-up. And it's like he's taking you through the backstage corridors. And then right as he comes on stage and we know him through Saturday Night Live, that's where it ends. So it's sort of this subterranean journey. And I wanted the book to be like that. I also felt like I had perspective on Slater-Kinney, but mostly I just felt like the shape of the band was the best way to tell the story.
Ooh, and it was so successful because in those final like pages of the book, when you finally like get on stage, I sobbed. It just felt so good. I was like, she made it and it works. Oh, does it work? I was just like howling in my hotel room. Do you guys want to hear more about my howling? No. Okay. Okay, I'm having my own experience up here, and you guys are leaving me high and dry, and that's fine. Okay, I think along with that...
You want me to laugh into the mic when I laugh?
Yes, I really do. And I want it to be like a cartoon laugh, like every time, like change it to like a hee-hee-hee or like a ha-ha-ha.
See, I'm just naturally put it... Okay, I'll laugh directly into it.
Thank you. Okay. I feel that this next question kind of goes along with what we were just talking about. I loved... Oh my God, who freaking called the cops? We about to burn the roof off this motherfucker. I can't curse in a library. What am I doing? Okay, back to my heavy, heavy notes. One thing... Do you still hear it? I still hear it. Dang, Philly. Philly is no joke. Oh, they love that.
Me too. I know exactly what we're going to say. I keep thinking that something you're going to say, someone's going to change a slide, and it's not happening.
And I keep looking to see
me
like
too.
A picture or something.
I know.
And every time I'm even more shocked.
That's exactly how I feel.
I think because also when we came out here, we never got a moment to take in what was back there. And so now I just keep fixating on, like, what does it say and what's going on? And are they street signs or is it?
It's also, I just realized that it's not a screen. It's a shit.
Wow, she wrote a book, but she's not that smart.
There's something about the light, the way the light's hitting it from where I'm sitting that
yeah,
I thought it was...
Yeah, you're right. Free library of inspiration, and it's right here in front of you. Okay, look, I got a good question. Okay, I loved that the story was deeply about, like, the evolution of the sound. That was so fucking cool. And going back and listening to older albums, it like I had like a whole new appreciation. And I felt like throughout the book you kept writing about how like it always felt like it was halfway there or like three-fourths of the way there, that it was never quite like fully working on all levels. And I was curious if after the tour of No Cities to Love and that album and its success and those tours with those fans who had waited for so long for that, did it feel on that tour like it's working? We got it. It's all levels like pumping.
Well, I should clarify that I think sonically, I mean, there were definitely albums I felt very satisfied with, and I think...
Did I fuck up?
I think, but there was always a sense, you're right, that, you know, there was... Gosh, to humorous effect, there was always something, or sometimes to tear, and I feel like we should wait.
Woo!
Also, hold for the siren.
Normally at shows, I have to hold for applause.
No, I was not asking for that, but thank you.
Crowd work.
Love to do my crowd work. Who here is from Philly? Okay, cool. Who else is here? Not that good at crowd work. Now, if you guys want to give me a suggestion of anything at all, and I'll make a fun character about it. I don't want to do that. It's a disgrace to this library for me to do that. Okay. Yes, I don't want you to think that I didn't feel like everything was always working, because it always was working.
It wasn't always working, but I mean, I just mean like in terms of the albums. I think things did coalesce with, there were certain things that kind of coalesced with each album, but it never was all at once. You know, like,
yes.
Okay, well, this time we got this right,
mm-hmm.
and then, what, you know, this.
Yes,
thing.
It was like, I felt like each time it was like, ooh, the producer's good this time, but this time we don't have a drummer. Like, it was just like you were always... There were like such...
That's not in the book. We've always had a drummer. I mean, that's true. Actually, we did get rid of like... we fired maybe four drummers.
Yeah, so I'm not making this shit up.
But yeah, with No Cities, we just had a different perspective on it.
Yes.
We weren't in this sort of hamster wheel where you just lose perspective of how wonderful it can be, how not to take it for granted, how ephemeral... and momentary it can all be. And so when to have that privilege, I guess, of coming back and with an album that people really loved, and instead of looking at it through the lens of sentimentality, you know, people, for some people, that was the first album they'd ever heard by us, which was the biggest gift we could get for this tour.
Yeah.
I loved that. It's so nice to tour on a record that people want to hear.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think with No Cities, you know, we had figured it out, but we'd also had 8 years off to figure it out.
Totally.
It would have felt worse if we hadn't figured it out with eight years off. Got to figure it out in 8 years.
Okay. Good to know.
8 years.
Got to put 8 years into it every time. All right. I have one more, and then we can just loosey-goosey ride until we see what happens. Till another
Which siren. We haven't been doing yet.
I know. Make it seem like I'm very rigid and very prepared.
You are very prepared.
Thank you. Thank you. I just realized that...
Yes, you're going to say something about the chair. I've been feeling it the whole time, too.
Ooh. To me, and this is too personal, and I shouldn't say this in this gorgeous library when there's like a beautiful chandelier here.
I love how this is a library.
This is a library, and you know it.
We're aware it's not a library.
This crowd
this is
throwing
this
shade.
Is a screen. This is a screen, and this is a library. You guys are
cuckoo. Look, what I was going to say is that these chairs are the exact color of my period blood. And if you want to know more about it, call me. And in a way, like, I wish I would have had these in middle school, because I would have never worried ever again. For the rest of my life, I would have been like, I don't know if I have a tampon in. I'm chilling. Why am I here? I'm not qualified.
You're totally qualified. I'm enjoying this so much. I just want you to do stand-up. This is why I had a variety of people interview me, because I can just sit here and you can crack jokes, and I can just sit on stage and laugh, and I love it.
Oh.
This is my favorite thing.
I know.
I mean, because what can I say about the book that's not in the book? It's in the book. It's in the
book.
It
is in the book.
What, I mean...
I know. I've kind of been making you just, like, talk more about the book.
No. That is the point, but we could talk about anything. I worry that your period blood is this color.
You feel that it's not dark enough?
It's not dark enough. This to me is salmon.
And wow. I guess to me, I'm thinking this is first day, last day.
That's not true. Last day is darker than this.
What?
It should be.
My last day is like a small exhale. Just like a... And then all the days in between are like,
It's, you've just described yourself as a heavy vagina breather for a couple days.
So what? I don't care. Yeah, it's gross. But it makes me, Carrie. I don't know. Everybody does their own thing. I keep being struck by, like, how gorgeous the chandelier is.
In the library. I know. I love when they put a chandelier like that in the library, and then it's just rows and rows of seats.
I do, too. Nothing to me says books like a big stage.
Yeah.
No. That's cool. Who else is going to talk to you on these things?
I feel like you should just come along for the rest.
I would do that.
I think this period shtick is going to go over really well. I'd like to show that off to my mom and dad in Seattle.
Oh, my God. Hey, guys, read a lot about you. Guess what? My period blood is a little lighter on the late day. Do you think they would like that?
I mean, sure. They've... Yes, my parents love menstruation humor.
It actually is the only kind of humor that I like, I'm finding about myself. And it does feel like that's not really what, like, I don't know, like, works on SNL or whatever. Kind of isn't, like, what is
I'll tell you
good.
What, though. It's good for promoting books. This book.
If you like period blood at all, this is the one for you.
Yeah.
I really do mean that.
Oh. It's a reusable pad.
What else? I mean, I have real questions, but I feel like now we're just like hanging out, right?
I feel like the audience can ask the real questions and...
Yeah, we'll do a Q&A and...
If you have, I mean...
No.
Okay.
I mean,
no.
I feel like they'll get into it. Like,
okay. I think so, too.
All right, let's just go head-to-head here and see what happens.
About with what? Oh, I thought we were literally turning it over to the audience.
Oh, we can. I thought we were going to, like, arm wrestle or something.
Yes. You know what? A really horrible story I heard once was that you can break your arm during arm wrestling, and I know a couple people who have claimed that their arm snapped.
I feel that I would.
This is
snap
not in the book.
Arm.
My opinion on arm wrestling isn't, but I've stopped arm wrestling since then. Did you ever see the Stallone movie Over the Top? Or is that what it's called?
No, yeah. But so many people here have.
Well, Stallone has a relationship with Phil, Rocky in Philly. Is like.
Yeah,
a,
you're right.
No, that's like not anymore, I guess. But I don't feel like Stallone the other night in Brooklyn. We brought up Mel Gibson. Like, why? Stallone, I don't think, conjures the same negativity as Mel Gibson, right? Right? Stallone hasn't turned into, like, a...
No, I think he's just kind of like a piece of beef who talks. Whereas, like, Mel Gibson is, like, a bigot. Right?
Yeah. That's exactly... That's on both of their...
That's my impression.
Yeah. No, that's straight off both of their IMDb pages.
That's cool.
Over the Top is a film. I think he's also a truck driver. And
he... Yes. Yes, he is. Praise be to him. Yes.
And he's an arm wrestler on top of that.
Whoa.
And I think, does he have a son with him?
This is your favorite movie. And you've been waiting all night to bring it up.
Well, I did. I one thing I talked about the other night was I... This is just Philadelphia. Okay.
Okay. I keep thinking that it's going to be like one of those club songs, you know, where it's like, whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. You guys remember that song, right? I do a ton of hip-hop sound bites. If you need any of that. Period humor and hip-hop sound bites. It's what I got on lock. All right, I'm going to kick back.
I was going to tell you what I had in my room on my walls as a kid. But what did you have?
Oh man, I mean, I was okay. I lived in Arizona, so yikes, right? And I think early on, I was like, I'm a woman who loves hockey, and so I had like a signed hockey stick of the Phoenix Coyotes, which they're not good, and they never have been. And then I had a poster of one of the men on there.
I had a... Brian Bosworth was a guy that signed to the Seattle Seahawks and notoriously had signed for, like, a ton of money, and he had a mohawk. And I had a poster of... he was called the Boz. And it was him in... it was the land of Boz. And it was like a Wizard of Oz thing. And oh, it was amazing. There was like a hot girl that was like Dorothy, but in like a sexy dress. And like a little Toto. Anyway, I had that on my wall. And then after my mom moved out and my dad was in charge of decorating, the first thing he put up was a Michael Jordan wingspan.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was like all like the Hockneys came down. Like my mom had like decent taste, or like David Hockney down and then Michael Jordan up.
That is cool.
We like basically, it was like a frat house. And like my sister was in high school like collecting beer cans and bottles. And I was like, I don't think this is appropriate. But you know, if the art on the wall is a basketball player, it's, you know.
That's gorgeous.
Thank you. And it wasn't framed. It was just mounted, which is right out of a dorm room.
But I feel like for a long time, just like mounting a poster on like a hard poster board was like enough.
Absolutely, it's enough.
I had one of those posters that was from Spencer's Nagle? Gifts.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no. It was just like different smiley faces. That was just like... like all different like smiley faces with tongues, and I remember just being like, I am fucking cool. I thought that was so cool and I loved it so much. And I also had like Hanson posters for a while.
I had New Kids on the Block, and they were, and I always
who was your guy in there?
Well, here was my strategy. Because you have a strategy when, like, you're obsessed with a boy band or a girl band. Well, there's mostly boy bands, like, in terms of this genre. Everyone wanted Jordan Knight. Mm-hmm. But I was like, he's unattainable. Mm-hmm. If you pick the person that less people like, you have a better chance.
Very sad, very practical.
I'm very pragmatic, so I was like, Danny. But then Danny was, like, too... So I was like, okay, Jonathan Knight. Like... Danny, no, but Jonathan Knight.
Yeah.
And that was, that's like my soap opera story. As a kid, I really wanted people's autographs, but they would not write me back. And I was like, you know who will write me back? Daytime soap stars. And they did.
I love that.
You have to be strategic as a fan. If you want to date someone in a boy band, you've got to go for the one that people think is less traditionally attractive.
AJ. From the Backstreet Boys.
It works out. You dated AJ. I dated Jonathan Knight.
Yeah. I would never date AJ. I think he's revolting. Okay. And now we are going to turn it over to you guys. So we're going to bring the house lights up a little bit, I think, because I can't see. And I think there's microphones. There's one there and one there. And then for y'all up at the top, there are some over there, too. So... We can just form lines at those, and maybe the lights up just a little bit more if we can. It's really dark for some reason. But hey there over there. Yeah, why don't you start us off?
Hey.
And maybe say your name, too. Why not?
Okay. Should I take this off of here?
Yeah, do whatever you want. We're freaking chilling in this library.
Okay, so this has been really entertaining. I've never watched really SNL, so this is awesome.
Woo! Burn right off the top, and that is very cool. Have you ever seen Girls or Broad City? I'm on those, too.
Nope.
That's fair. You know what? Go to YouTube and type in Melissa McCarthy, and that's me.
But I'm a fan now, so I will be watching.
That's nice. Sorry, yeah. I went insane right now.
No, I was the person to just go to watch those shows if my favorite band was on them. Hey, Carrie, good to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
So my question, it's a serious question. So I'm just curious, I haven't read the book yet because I just got it tonight. So I don't know if you go into this or anything. But I'm just curious about, I guess I haven't read anything about how you guys get into like writing set lists for the shows.
Actually, that's not in the book, so.
Yeah, because I went to a bunch of shows this past tour, and I know towards the end you guys started changing it up, or when you're doing like multi-night runs in the same cities, and somebody who follows bands on tours, I'm just curious about that, so, yeah.
Wait, so what did you say someone was?
Following bands on tour.
Oh, following bands. Well, we always do a different set list. I think some bands play the same set list every night, and there's a lot of reasons to do that that are practical and logistical. We like to change it up, and I will tell you exactly how the set list is made, which is that Janet Weiss makes it every single night.
Janet fucking Weiss.
Yep. Corin and I give a cursory glance to that. We know basically, obviously we've practiced all the songs, but Janet is the set list master, and we don't mess with that. She loves doing it. She takes a lot of pride in it. She thinks about it a lot, and we just let her do it. That's how it's been for a really long time.
Great, thank you very much.
I love that. How about we go over here now? We do a little flip and a flop.
Should I take it down?
Yeah, what the hell? Let's rip it up.
All right, well, you know, swing it. So my friend and I drove from, there she is right there.
Woo!
Hey.
We drove from Virginia to see this.
Both
of you guys.
That's so nice.
That's super nice.
I mean, you're welcome. And we were talking the whole six-hour drive about, you know, what's something really smart we could ask Carrie? Because Carrie's always, like, dropping big words and shit. Excuse, sorry. And we couldn't think of anything. So we really, honestly, the only thing we could talk about was that we just wanted to play Desert Island with you.
Sure. Well, with what topic, though?
I'm going to give it to you.
Okay.
Right now. It's going to drop right here. Best artist or album or comedian, book, whatever you could take on an island, your three favorites.
Okay. This is always so hard.
And this is being recorded, so everybody's going to see it.
Okay.
So.
It probably would change day to day. Honestly, the only way I can do this now is to talk about things I'm reading and doing and listening to right now. Because to go back, it's too hard. So three things, if today someone... this is what I'll explain. I'm in the process of moving, and so I've been packing up a lot of things. And
you're leaving Portland?
Well, no, but we shoot Portlandia there. So, but I'm just moving houses. The three things I would take, or that I didn't pack because I wanted them, was this book by Claudia Rankine called Citizen. I could read that. I guess I would have to read it for eternity, so that's the question.
Yeah, every day.
I'll take the Kendrick Lamar album, To Pimp a Butterfly.
Yes.
You could listen to that every day and hear something new in it. What else did I keep around? Oh, this Joy Williams book that I'm, The Visiting Privilege, which is a really wonderful collection of her short stories, plus about 13 new ones. I, I could also read that over and over. So today, that's what I would take on a desert island.
Boom, awesome. She nailed it.
Awesome, nailed it.
What's up over here?
Hi. What happened to Wild Flag, and why did you go back to Slater-Kinney?
You know, it's really hard to be in a band with people that live on the opposite coast, especially when I have other things that I do in the summers, including Portlandia. So it just was a little bit of a logistical problem. So we went back to... Mary played with people from D.C. and East Coast, and I played with people in the town I live in.
Cool. Thanks.
Cool. The world is crazy. Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
This is just a question about something I always sort of wondered about. You speak a little bit about this in the book. When the self-titled album came out, you talk about how you wanted to create a different last name or use a different name, and the first two albums you're credited as Carrie Kinney, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that, what the impetus for that was, and then why you decided to go back to Brownstein for Call the Doctor and all the subsequent albums. Thank you.
Sure. I think I talk about it, yeah, a little bit in the book. Everyone in Olympia at the time, like everybody in a band, was like changing their names to something. At the time, there was a trend to kind of do a pun or a play on words. Like there was another Carrie, and her name was like Karaoke. And I was like, you know, it's like you're trying to figure out like your punk name. And I just never really settled on a punk name. That just didn't seem like who I was. I kept thinking about my grandparents, and I was like, nah, I should just stick with that name.
Hell yeah. What's up?
What's up? Adie, you are the queen.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I need you to talk to that other girl after this.
Oh, no, right. SNL. I was like, are you?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, are you telling us that there's also people, by the way?
Oh, okay. There? I will hit you up next, my players. Yo, my girl, what's your question?
Oh, thanks, girl. I'm going to get real deep with this.
Good.
Real quick.
So. Is it for 80 or?
No.
Okay. No, but I was just hoping it might be since you wanted to go really deep. It's like this, trying to like keep the tenor of the show. It's like super light, and then it's like, I'm about to go really deep. It's scarier because we haven't been deep the whole,
I feel like
actually menstruation is as deep as it goes. So I hope if your question is about feces, basically, that's the only place darker than where we've already gone.
But also, please don't ask a question about feces.
Side note, I can't go deep with the period chair. That's a little too much.
Okay.
Carrie, I think I've only read part of the book, but so from a personal experience, I've been through a handful of health problems and things like that, traveling over in hospitals. In part of your book, you were talking about going into the hospital where your mother was and the smell of it, and it was just, when you go there, it was like a flashback, and for me, it was like the same thing, thinking about it. So that really spoke to me. I just wanted to thank you for that. But also, you spoke about how Fred is a very yes person and used to be a no person, opening up and being vulnerable, especially through your music. What kind of changed your mindset from a no person to a yes person?
I mean, I think just there's a essayist named Charles D'Ambrosio that I read this. I love his essays, and I read this interview with him. Loitering is a book to check out of his, and he talks about the writing as a way of, it's a dream of making the distance go away, and I think that when you are in a place that's detached, you might feel this kind of objectivity or sort of remove, but you also feel a sense of longing and loss. And I think you just get to a point where you don't want to feel that anymore. I think that I used to feel like someone that went, it was like I was like a headless person that went into rooms with my head on a platter and the head had a big smile on it. But here it was. And music for me and through performance was a way of, I realized, like, you know what, I can put that head back on my body and it doesn't have to be wearing a smile. That to me was the yes to, the no to yes. Just a sense of letting go of the divided self, because it just keeps you at a distance from people. I have so many great, loves in my life and have for many years, just wonderful people. I feel very fulfilled. I have a very rich life. And so it's a kind of an important place to get to, I think, for a lot of things, you know. I think defiance and no is still like an important way of thinking, but you also have to be able to like realize when to just embrace openness too, you know. So that's been better for me.
I love that. Let's go up to the top over there. Yo.
Hi. So first off, your music has gotten me through immensely difficult and great times in my life, and I want to thank you, Janet and Corin, for that. And kind of with that, it's been my ultimate driving music since I got my license years ago. So if you were to flash to a moment, maybe in when you were talking about 1996 earlier, when the three of you guys are in a van and you're like belting along to some horrible pop radio hit, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
96, you know what? We never listened to the radio.
Or even some dark like, album.
I will tell you what we listened to. We listened to, this is so nerdy, Armistead Maupin's Tale of the City. Tales of the City, we listened to that. I know you're imagining that we're like flying along listening to something. We couldn't wait. We like when the iPod came out, we were like, thank God. And we used to listen to our own music. Whoever drove was in charge of the music. So God, what do we like? Corin always listened to Neutral Milk Hotel. And I don't remember what, I feel like I don't know what I listened to. I feel like I was the one in charge of that book on tape, which I think really probably annoyed everyone. Actually, we all got pretty into that. But yeah, we didn't really have, there's a lot of hours. It's like, you know that thing like in a movie, they show like a road trip and it lasts like 2 seconds and it's just like, woo! It's like, imagine that for 10 hours. Like, I don't know what we listened to. It's numbing. I have no idea. I just read the whole time. I was like, you got to turn down the music.
What's up there?
Hi. First, I want to, I'm a strategic fan. Do you write back?
Wait, what?
If I write you a letter, do you write back?
I have been answering questions sometimes via social media. It depends. Yes, if you have a specific question, I still do write back sometimes.
I did have another.
If I get the letter, I mean, I'm just saying I don't get a lot of real letters anymore. But when people reach out on social media, I try to write back all the time.
I also wanted to know. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I wanted to know if you were speaking to your 9-year-old self, what would you say?
Oh well, I would definitely just tell myself to chill out. I was really just to be less anxious and worried. You know, there was I was a really really worried kid, and I really wanted somebody to tell me that things were going to be okay. I unfortunately didn't really have the kind of childhood where people tell you it's going to be okay. But I would wish I could have said like, "You're going to be fine. Just wait until you're 17 and can head out." But yeah,
I like to hear that now.
Yeah, I mean,
like I kind of like to hear that all the time.
Yes, like if you're choosing friends, choose friends that are there to tell you you're going to be okay.
You're going
to
be okay.
You're going to be okay.
Okay, you're going to be okay. What's your question?
Oh, thank you. Hi, thank you for being here. I was just wondering, I recently read, Carrie, that you like The Bachelor. And I was wondering if you could speak to us about that for a minute.
I don't know who doesn't love The Bachelor. I feel, no, so many people hate The Bachelor. I will tell you, I have a really weird reason for liking The Bachelor. I moved to the Bay Area in 2004, and I was very homesick. And I was writing songs that would later become like Modern Girl and Jumpers and end up on the album The Woods. And I, at night, once a week, the show The Bachelor was on, and I started to notice that there was a contestant from Portland. And I was like, gosh, I miss Portland. Every time she's on, saying a lot of vapid things. but they, by the way, which is how they edit the show. I mean, you know, it's not, this is not a dumb woman. This is like, this is whatever. Anyway, so she's on just talking about the stupid stuff they're asking her about. And I was just like, Meredith, please get to the final four and I will get to see Portland, Oregon on TV. And she did. She made it. She made it to the final four. And then they went and did all the dumbest things. You know, of course, it's like the worst things in Portland. But I was so happy. I was like, there's Meredith's house. They're on the waterfront. So you guys are like, I can't believe Carrie likes The Bachelor. No, I like The Bachelor because it saved me from being homesick. Plus, I just love The Bachelor. I don't care. I don't care. I love that show. It's tawdry. It's...
I also love that
it's
show.
It's manipulative. I love the show Unreal, which is like the behind the scenes of The Bachelor. The Bachelor is the darkest pathway into the American psyche. It is the craziest thing. It's like, why, it's the worst version of romance and aspiration and femininity and like the masculine and the feminine and gender roles. It's awesome. It's just like darkest chasm of all of that.
I love it. What's up?
This guy? Hey.
Hey.
Is it Ada? Ida?
Holy hell. It's
80?
80. 80.
All right, shit. Sorry.
Don't worry about it, buddy.
Carrie, 80, I just want to thank you guys first for coming to Philadelphia.
Well, thanks for having us.
And you're going to make me watch SNL. I've been
oh, my gosh. It's time. Like SNL's yeah. a show people are just hearing
so anyway,
about.
Yeah.
You know what? Don't even
So, yo,
watch
yo, yo,
it.
Yo, yo, back to Carrie.
It sucks. Life sucks for me.
Yeah.
What's so how many seasons has SNL been on?
Just like 40.
40.
This is yeah. season 41.
Yeah.
Thanks, you guys. Yeah. Let's get to the question for Carrie.
So anyway, I just wanted to give my girl a shout out. She bought tickets. She put a bird on it, literally. It's on her shirt.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah. So anyway.
And you're awesome. And I love that she's filming you asking this question.
Yeah,
I love
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
I
don't know where the hell this is going to go on fucking social media. But anyway, so I have two questions. One, a comment. So I saw this thing on YouTube recently. You and Fred went to a actual feminist bookstore in Portland. And I just thought it was, you don't remember.
Wait, we filmed at a feminist bookstore in Portland.
Yeah. It was funny. And it was like... And you were like, they were like, what's like sort of the craziest shit you did? And you were like, well, one time I put a stamp on backwards. I thought that was really funny.
I don't even know what this
is. You don't remember saying that?
What put a stamp on backwards?
You put a stamp on backwards on an envelope and mailed it. And that was like your anarchy. You said that.
I love this guy.
Whatever.
I do too.
You have a question?
Yeah, I know. So here's my other question. So Sleater-Kinney, I saw them. You opened up for Pearl Jam a couple years ago in Philly. And I just wonder if you had any cool stories about the band backstage. That's it. And
well,
first of all, I love
you. Let
me
say first, you should definitely read the book because she talks a lot about touring with Pearl Jam. And it's amazing.
A lot about touring with Pearl Jam. This is definitely a kind of a read the book question because I have so much affection for Pearl Jam and for Eddie. Oh, my God. He's one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever met. When we played with them, it was really hard because we had never... played venues that size, and their audience was at the beginning very ambivalent towards us and towards any opener because they feel so strongly about Pearl Jam.
And that's very similar to how many of you feel about me tonight.
And I it's intense. So, you know, but what Eddie would do, and this is an example of how generous the whole band is, he would come out with a guitar or a ukulele and play a song, usually like a Beatles song. And so people would hear, people that were still getting their, you know, coming in through the gates or out buying food, they would run to their seats because Eddie was singing. And he'd finish the song and he would say, please listen to Sleater-Kinney. I mean, that kind of generosity from a musician or from anyone is really incredible. And he's really, the whole band is really special.
That's amazing. That's so wonderful.
And everyone I meet that's met Eddie says he's the nicest person I've ever met. And I would have to agree, he really is a special human.
I love that. Oh, sorry, I should go up here one.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, right up there.
I'm a little short, so I'm going to try and take this out. No? Does it screw out? I'm confused. Okay. What network is that SNL on? I've never heard of it. No.
It's ABC.
Oh, okay. Great. It's,
ABC
okay,
Family.
Perfect. Yep. Perfect.
We're on right after Hocus Pocus. Mm-hmm.
The Disney Channel.
She's walking out. She's walking out. Sorry. Go ahead.
Early in your book, you talk about coming up as a young person and in the time where you were still feeling like an outsider, seeing other people be really bold, especially about social politics and like the radical feminist and queer scene, and trying to deal with the pushback of anything they said and being called out on and things like that. And I related to that very like present day, I think, especially with social media and the internet. And obviously you want to be accountable for everything you say, but there can be so much pressure on trying to put out any like creative or original thoughts because of fear of that pushback and on such a grand scale. Because of how many people you can reach in a matter of seconds. So I guess coming from that feeling as an outsider to now, you know, feeling like an insider, what advice would you give to someone now in the age of, you know, Facebook and Twitter and everything else?
We can quote our friend earlier who said something amazing.
Yes, and we said it back and forth about 10 times.
Yeah, she said... In relation to what you're talking about, social media, and or just the nature of press right now, you know, people are required to speak, but they're asked not to say anything. And I was like, yeah, that's totally true. Like everyone wants someone's opinion, but we really don't want someone's real opinion if mm-hmm. it's offensive or. And you're gonna offend someone. That's my advice. You are definitely going to offend somebody, and. You kind of have to just not care. I mean, it's better to have an opinion that you, and that just say what you feel and what you mean. If you have the nerve, if you have the constitution to, not everyone can. I mean, not everyone wants to be subject to that kind of criticism. But it creates terrible art if everybody is so worried about what everyone else is thinking. It creates a really low level of discourse if we're hyper concerned. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be hyper aware or hyper careful as you set out, but you know, I mean, I'd rather get into an interesting constructive conversation with someone. Unfortunately, it's not always civil, but you know, I would say you know, just know that you cannot possibly operate in this world right now without offending someone if you were going to say something out loud.
Yes, and I feel like living in fear of that is like, what can you even do? Fear is the enemy of creativity.
Yeah, and it's the enemy of thought, and it's the enemy of progress.
Yes.
I mean, so, yeah. I mean, I just speak your mind and then be ready to fight back.
I'm sorry to say that we only have time for one more question. So, I am going to... go to this woman who demanded it. And I'm sorry to you guys. I wish we could have gotten to every single one of you. But tweet at us.
I'm still going to tweet.
Okay.
So. Thank you guys both for being here. I'm such a big fan of you both. Carrie, I've been a fan of your music as well as your acting, but mostly a fan of your writing. I myself am a writer. I'm here with my writer friend. I know there's many of us in the audience who are also writers. My question is, as a woman of the 21st century, multitaskers are we all, and having kind of many different hats, many different careers, how do you prioritize or make a habit out of your writing, not necessarily the things that you're hired to do, but the things that you want to do, the things that you're passionate about?
Ooh, good question to end on,
yes,
yeah?
Great question.
Woo!
Thank you for that question. I mean, a lot of it is... ritual and routine and just sitting down with the task at hand. There is nothing magic
there's no magic that goes into the process of work. I feel like I get up really early. I don't go out at night very often. I have wonderful dinners with friends and see a lot of people whom I love, but I am quite disciplined, and I think anyone you talk to that is multitasking, and I'm not talking about working yourself to the bone or at the jeopardy of your own health or at the expense of your loved ones. I'm talking about just pursuing your passion and doing what you love. Everyone I know that's doing that, and to no matter what degree of success, is really putting in the time. And I do. I mean, with writing in particular, if I allow myself even a moment in the morning of distraction, whether that's looking at the New York Times before I open up the document or check my email or text one person, it's like my brain goes down a pathway of distraction and procrastination. And so it really is just about this discipline of sitting down and doing the work and making time and valuing myself and valuing the work enough for that allowance. It is a lot of logistics, but it really always boils down to discipline and intention, I find. So I think you just have to, whatever your routine is, I've always been a morning person. I was saying that when I was working on this book, I would sometimes set my alarm for 4:30 in the morning because I think best up until around noon. And which makes, yes, you're thinking, how did you ever go on tour? Well, it was hard. I write best from about, I would write, make coffee and write from about 5 till 10. Then I would maybe take my dogs on a walk. It was nice to just reset. Then I would come back and write for a couple more hours. And really, that was it. That was all I could handle. That's, I was done at noon. And then you're done at noon. Then you just drink the rest of the day. So, anyway.
Yes, that's where we'll leave it. Thank you so much.
Anyway, you guys have been so wonderful.
Library of Philadelphia. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks to 80.
Thanks to Carrie.
Thanks to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Yes. Woohoo!
All right.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.